Governor Holcomb officially launches his re-election campaign. Susan Brooks breaks with her party over a rebuke of Donald Trump. Plus, Buttigieg speaks to young Dems in Indy and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending July 19, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world. Working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Republican Governor Eric Holcomb kicked off his re-election campaign at the Hoosier Gym in Knightstown with a new slogan, Putting People First. Holcomb seeks to center his campaign on individual success stories that match up with his priorities as governor. Holcomb touted past accomplishments, workforce development, tackling the opioid epidemic, and infrastructure investments, while looking forward with an emphasis on improving infant mortality, the Department of Child Services, and job training for inmates. Holcomb officially begins his re-election bid with a sizable financial advantage, more than $6 million in his campaign war chest. Just how comfortable will this re-election campaign be for Eric Holcomb? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, putting people first, will that be the winning strategy for Eric Holcomb?
Right after swine, right? We can spend $44 million on the swine bar. Heaven forbid we should give teachers the raises that they're entitled to or the kids the education that they're entitled to. I mean, it's a slogan. It doesn't mean anything. And certainly it isn't even consistent with his conduct. But I think that was it was a nice event, obviously, I wasn't there, but by all accounts.
You were invited.
By all accounts, it was a nice event, and it's good for him to introduce himself to the people of Indiana, none of whom know him. So it'll be good to see how he can, begin to sell himself.
Governor Holcomb, if there's been a criticism, a consistent criticism of him, is that he hasn't put forward the big ideas.
Not even the little ones.
He hasn't put forward a lot of big ideas in his time as governor. So is putting people first telegraphing a big idea?
Well, I think putting people first reflects what he has been doing, which is, if he gets out of bed every day concerned about things that affect average people or people in the state. So he cares about infrastructure. He cares about if you're addicted to drugs, he cares about opioid use reduction. If you're in prison and you're coming out, he cares about making sure you have a certificate or some way that you're not going to go back. He cares about workforce development. Are you in the next level jobs program, finishing high school, getting a work certificate, going to college? How are we improving people's lives? And Eric Holcomb is a lot like Mitch Daniels in that he views his time as governor, that he's a governor for everybody. And so he's not going to attach himself to some niche kind of political partisan issue necessarily. He's going to look for things that affect the most people that need it and that state government can help. And that's been the theme of his first 2.5 years. And it's going to be rhetorically the theme going forward.
I want to ask this. He just said that Eric Holcomb is like Mitch Daniels in that these are the things he's focused on. But it felt like with Mitch Daniels, you could immediately attach, for better or for worse.
We had 16 years of Democrats, and nothing happened. So we had a lot of big things in the pipeline.
We need to weed the garden, just as Mitch Daniels said, after 16 years.
So is that the problem? Is that after how many years of Republican
BMV waiting lines, he shortened the lines at the BMV, and then changed daylight saving time. Once those issues are done, what's left to conquer in Indiana?
I mean, that's the budget. That's all. We continue to do the things that Mitch Daniels did, which include balance the budget. We have a record surplus. We have record investments in education.
Baby steps. And like, for example, when he says that he's saving
$3 million. Infrastructure plan.
$3 million if he funds the infrastructure the way he's talking about. And in several years, that'll make some difference to teachers. $100 a piece.
Maybe a lightning bolt will come down. But does every successful politician have to lay out some 4,000-part
apparently
plan?
Apparently not. That, no, he's got about 60% approval.
Okay, that upends the status quo. I mean, he has doubled down on good government, pragmatic government, that his mantra has been for everybody. Again, not there have
like
been
the VA?
There have been partisans on both sides who say, I'm going to gin up my base, I'm going to throw a little red meat here, a little red meat there, and then I'll govern at the margins. I think this is a different approach. And maybe it comes about because as an electorate, it had grown reform weary. I mean, I mean, how many times have we reformed education? How many times have we
reformed? I'm not talking about reforming education. I'm talking about paying teachers.
Let me ask this, though, then. Fundamentally, really, does Eric Holcomb just not need to screw up too bad and he'll be fine?
Yeah, look, I mean, you can't say never, but he obviously has, you know, he's in a commanding position. You know, I think the one thing that is kind of out there on the edge is if teachers coalesce in an organized way. The putting people first thing was your slogan, but I just thought when John was talking, maybe it should be like, not sexy, but solid, you know? I mean, maybe that's his thing.
That is exactly his performance. It's solid, in the sense that he hasn't done anything that changes anything, and so therefore he hasn't screwed up, except perhaps with the VA. But, you know, other than that,
but if you look at things such as budgetary reserves, you look at a relatively robust economy.
We're not a bank. The reason you have the reserves and the credit rating is to
if the economy were worse, he'd have a
The biggest contrast right now is because we're in a campaign. We have a governor who has raised a record amount of money. We've got a senior staff that's coming back to run this campaign. We've got the best state party we've ever had. No, everybody but me. But we have record dollars. We have a record organization. And right now, that matters a lot if you contrast it to Democrats who have no money, who have a candidate who lives in New York City and has been trying to sell his house here for 3 years.
All right.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we post an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, will Governor Eric Holcomb win a second term in 2020? A yes or B no? Last week's question, would State Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick, a Republican, make a good lieutenant governor candidate for Democrats in 2020? 62% of you said she would, but 38% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, 5th District Representative Susan Brooks was one of only four Republicans in the U.S. House this week to vote for a resolution condemning President Trump's recent racist attack against four Democratic congresswomen. Trump tweeted Sunday that four members of Congress, all Democrats and women of color, should go back to their countries. Such language has long been used as a racist attack against people of color, besides the fact that three of the four congresswomen were born in the U.S. Republican Congresswoman Susan Brooks issued a statement on social media, calling Trump's comments inappropriate and saying they don't reflect American values. She then became one of four House GOP members to vote for a resolution to strongly condemn the president for the tweets. Brooks announced last month she won't run for re-election next year. Mike O'Brien, is it a coincidence that Brooks isn't running again and voted for this resolution?
Made it easier, right? I mean, you save yourself the blowback. I mean, I think the reasons that she said that she's not running for re-election are the motivating ones, which is they're in a different part of life. Kids are all over the country and grown, and they want to spend time. They want to invest their time there, so I think that's real. But I'm sure she analyzed these types of situations. I'm sure she did, because otherwise you couldn't make a complete decision. And this is incredibly, 2 weeks ago, I really thought there was a path, and I still do, on the policy of immigration policy. I thought Republicans, because Democrats had gone so far to the left on open borders, on buying health care, on some of the policy planks that they've adopted and pushed, that it gave Republicans a window to come in and say, look, we need rational policies at the border because we have a record number of illegal crossings every day. It's three times what it was 2 years ago. But then you have people, you know, you have protesters to ICE showing up at detention facilities with guns and throwing Molotov cocktails in, and they're getting shot. And it's just crazy. But what we're going to lose that is if the president continues to do this. I mean, Congresswoman Omar should be the example of successful immigration policy. I mean, this woman was born in Somalia, in war-torn Somalia, comes to the United States, becomes a citizen, gets elected to Congress. Nobody in that rally the other day could do that. Or would, frankly. And so we got to get out of the president has to get out of his own way on immigration policy, because I do think there's a path there. This is going to be a vigorous debate in the 2020 election, but it can't be if this is going to be the window dressing for it.
Susan Brooks was the only Republican, certainly from Indiana, to vote for the resolution. And she's also in arguably the most winnable district for Democrats, flippable district for Democrats next year. So will any of the other Republicans who didn't vote for it be held accountable for that in any way?
No, I don't think so. But I think that her vote on this is the best indicator that district is trending Democratic. I mean, finally, she's out from under the yoke of having to march to the Republican parade there that Donald Trump can do no wrong. I mean, she's been embarrassed by him numerous times in the past, and this is the first time she felt emboldened enough, because she isn't running again, to speak out. You know, and that's to her credit, and I wish more of the Republican Party would do the same. Democrats are not for open borders. The question was, health care is already provided to illegal aliens through emergency rooms.
Those are debates I have as a standalone matter.
We need legislation, and we needed legislation when Republicans were in control of both houses of Congress and the presidency, and did we get it? No. So the problem is not that the Democrats have moved too far to the left. The problem is the Republicans want to demonize anybody seeking asylum in the United States, and they want to label them all as either terrorists or rapists or murderers. That's the problem.
Over the last few years, there's been
a lot of
talk.
Some of them
are good people.
Over the last few years, we've heard a lot of talk about racist dog whistles. I would say this is just a whistle. Is with as short an attention span as we have anymore, is this the sort of issue, though, that has legs months out?
I don't know. These things flare up with President Trump all the time. And in the moment, you think, oh, my God, this is huge. And then, like, 4 days later, it's fine. So I've lost
track. Because there's something else happening. Right.
So I've lost track of what is going to be able to stick to the wall, so to speak. I will point out that, you know, none of Indiana's other congresspeople spoke out. So I think it's fair to say they are just fine with the president's words.
And again, I'll ask the same question. Is there any consequence for them on that?
No, I don't think so. There's no doubt that retiring emboldens people. In fact, Fred Upton from Michigan, and one of the other three individuals, Republicans, he's on a lot of retirement watch lists, so there is some rumor that he might be retiring too. And then if you look at the others, Will Hurd from Texas and Ryan Fitzpatrick from Pennsylvania, they're in districts, either they're in districts where they have felt a need to moderate their positions and vote Democratic.
Or Hurd is in a really diverse district.
He's in a diverse district, and then
Fitzpatrick
especially so. So, I mean, not altogether unexpected, but it's what this does. We shouldn't think about this, I don't think, does Donald Trump, you know, will he be able to avoid another one of these dust-ups? Because actually, this is, I think, if you look at history, his go-to strategy when he feels that either he wants to focus attention elsewhere or that he needs to gin up the base. This is what he does. Now, the only challenge is, of course, it does, I think, gin up a portion of his base, clearly. But it also
will it be enough?
Invigorates the other side. Yeah. So I think you have people who are a lot more frustrated, to say it euphemistically, with the president, this week after these comments than they were even a week ago. So it cuts both ways.
This is part of the strategy. It's part of the strategy.
Is it a strategy, though?
Oh, I think it is, because every time he has a failure, he does something like this or says something like this, so all the media attention's diverted from the fact that the ICE raids didn't happen.
Tactically, he does do that. This situation, I mean, given how he's treated the rally and the send her back situation in the days that have fought in the last 48 hours, he's changed his position three times on whether or not he supported it or not. I mean, you try to walk it back and say, look, I don't support that, which is the right approach,
position to take.
And a recognition that politically,
the
is going to be at every rally between now and next November is going to include send her back.
So Pete Buttigieg talked about that very thing yesterday when he issued a generational call to arms this week as he addressed the Young Democrats of America's National Convention here in Indianapolis. Buttigieg referenced the recent controversy over President Trump's racist tweets, condemning them while cautioning Democrats not to allow Trump to, quote, steal all the oxygen from the conversation.
We need to make them answer to our agenda, because ours is the agenda of the American people.
But Buttigieg was also met with chants of Black Lives Matter amid criticism of his record with communities of color. He acknowledged those chants and that criticism.
We've laid out what I believe is the most comprehensive plan in the 2020 field on what we're specifically going to do with intention to dismantle systemic racism in this country. The plan's very well received, but I got a lot of work to do to go out and communicate it.
John Schwanis, Buttigieg has stalled in the polls recently after that big upward climb. What does he need to do to regain that momentum that he had?
I'm not sure that there's a secret formula of lightning in the bottle, as you might say. Part of this is to be expected. If you look, again, I use history as a guide. It hasn't served me well in recent cycles, but if you go back far enough, it tends to help. And you look at to front runners, at people who sort of come onto the scene quickly, those that were really an unknown a month before. Everybody focuses on those individuals, and all of a sudden, some of the flaws and the blemishes, that it wears off. I mean, it's just natural. The more you know, familiarity, I guess, may breed contempt to a certain extent in politics as well. So a lot of times, if you look at both parties in the last 10 cycles, you see people who jump out a little bit because they're unknown. You can sort of read into them whatever you want them to be. They're the heroes.
But then you start to define
them, and every time they take a position, well, maybe some people say,
stand back and wait and see.
But I think it's natural. Some of that too. It's just natural.
We have another set of Democratic debates here in a couple weeks.
Right.
Does Buttigieg need a breakout moment from those debates?
Well, it would obviously help. I mean, right now he's got all the stuff going for him. He's a phenomenon right now. You know, he's raising ridiculous amounts of money, T-shirts and chants, and you know. But he's got to take that next step so that he's sort of a long haul candidate. And that would really help. Also, I think if there was some clarity in the whole shooting situation in South Bend,
it
might help.
Yeah. He raised more than any other Democratic candidate in the second quarter. Does that money need to start to turn into results in early state polls?
I think they will. I think as those debates occur, he acquits himself extremely well in those. He is sensible, he is moderate, he is thoughtful, and he is bright as well as articulate. And I think he stands out in the civility that he brings to those events as well. So I think that the bumps will come as the stage shrinks in going ahead, and the more that allows more focus on him. And I think he's going to do extremely well.
We saw what a breakout moment in the debate can do when Kamala Harris skyrocketed up into this top tier now. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to get a sense of this top tier pulling away as Biden, Sanders, Warren, Harris, and then a little drop to Buttigieg, and then a big drop to everybody else.
Right.
To avoid widening that gap between him and the rest of the top four, does he absolutely need to have a breakout moment in the next debate?
Well, I don't think it's a killer if he doesn't. I mean, because I think as this field narrows, but it becomes more risky and it becomes more pointed because you've got fewer targets to shoot at, right? I mean, there's like 10 people on each. There's 20 people on the entire debate stage. So there's not a lot of opportunity to really focus in on one candidate. But if he had a Senator Harris moment, then yeah, it kind of cements him. It cements him in that small group.
Yeah.
I mean, right now being at 4%,
you can't ever be sure in
a
debate that large whether the opportunity presents itself.
Right. But I mean, she saw an opportunity and grabbed it.
She grabbed it.
Handed
no, it was very effective.
At this point, he's like the Eric Holcomb of presidential candidates. He came from relative obscurity, and now he's skyrocketed to the top
ideas about what he wants to do.
You're saying he wants to go to the next level.
Yeah, he wants to go to the next level. And if he puts people first,
you bet on message the whole show.
Instead of swine.
Attorney General Curtis Hill's campaign says it's set a fundraising record in the recent quarter. Curtis Hill's campaign says it's raised $220,000 in the last 2 months, a record for an attorney general candidate at this point in the cycle. Hill hasn't held any sort of official re-election bid launch event, though he's clearly been raising money. The incumbent Republican already has a GOP challenger. Zionsville attorney John Westerkamp announced last month he will seek the nomination at the Republican convention next year. And Democrats are expected to focus heavily on the race in 2020. Hill is seen as vulnerable because of allegations he groped four women, including a state lawmaker. He currently faces a lawsuit from those women and a state disciplinary commission complaint. Nikki Kelly, how much of a shot across the bow is this from Curtis Hill?
I think he definitely wanted to show any potential challengers that he was going to be there to bring the money. It's interesting that he still hasn't announced, though. He's sort of keeping everyone waiting. Obviously, the big thing is he raised a lot of money, the majority of it from outside the state of Indiana. And last I checked, they're not going to be able to vote in the convention.
Yeah, I mean, 200...
I don't know, have you changed the rules?
We might.
200-something thousand dollars in today's world of politics and money doesn't seem like a lot, but when you're just talking about a convention fight, which is the first one he's going to have, is that a pretty big message you're sending, regardless of where the money came from?
Again, I think in the context of history, I'll go back to that, yeah, it's a lot of money. But in the modern political world, where any kind of television, any kind of very aggressive direct mail campaign, where you're targeting individuals who might be delegates, I mean, anything that's sophisticated is going to gobble that money up, I think, fairly quickly. So, yes, it's impressive that he departed from what we might say is sort of the patterns of pre-convention races in that for that particular job. But again, it's not going to stretch very far.
How much will money play a role in that convention fight? I mean, it's a very different kind of.
I mean, it does matter in terms of organization, your ability to, you know, keep and retain staff to work on your behalf. I mean, it's an exercise in how well organized you are, and money always helps in that effort in the context of a convention. I think, of course, it doesn't mean that much money in a general election in television.
And we've got a long time
anything,
until
right?
the general.
We have a long time there, but you got to think in terms of. So in 2020, I mean, we have a presidential campaign that is going to be a presidential campaign that is going to saturate everyone's attention.
Yep.
We have a gubernatorial race that is going to run secondary to that. How much secondary remains to be seen based on how the race shapes up. And we have this idea that this attorney general's race is going to be like front and center for people because of all these other issues. And I don't see that no matter who we nominate.
You just can't break through the noise.
You can't break through, and there's not enough money out there. Not enough people care.
Does this fundraising quarter, does this number he put out put anybody off from a challenge?
Well, you already have one announced candidate on the Republican side, so I don't think he's going to put anybody off. But it makes a big difference in the convention fight. Because remember, those delegates haven't been picked yet. And if you have the organizational skills and the money for staff, you can get people to run for those delegates.
Yeah,
and
right.
I thought all along he was going to be the nominee, so this just... is one more step towards that process.
All right. Well, speaking of Curtis Hill, this week he announced he will not appeal a federal judge's recent decision to temporarily halt the state's latest anti-abortion law. The 2019 law largely bans dilation and evacuation abortions, or DNEs, the safest and most common procedure for terminating a pregnancy in the second trimester. DNEs are rare. Only a couple dozen are performed in Indiana each year. Judge Sarah Evans Barker ruled in late June the new law unconstitutionally denies women access to DNEs and stopped it from taking effect. Attorney General Hill says he won't appeal that decision. Instead, he says he'll focus on defending the law in the future legal battle over permanently striking it down. And Delaney, will Indiana's anti-abortion activists, who Curtis Hill will need in that convention fight, be okay with his strategy here?
Look. This strategy of using taxpayer dollars to fund political campaigns, which is what this is, okay? The legislature passes bills they know are unconstitutional, and he runs in and he defends them knowing they're unconstitutional. All this has done for years is give funding to the American Civil Liberties Union. So maybe he can make the case to the anti-abortion activists that he's stopping the funding from the taxpayer dollars to the American Civil Liberties Union, because that's all this is. And they get struck down time after time. The ACLU gets their fees in this. They go back and they pass something else that they know is unconstitutional and do it all over again. And I'd like to know how many millions of dollars that's cost taxpayers.
It is in the millions of dollars. I mean, what we know so far, is it in the millions of dollars? I'll ask you the same question. For the anti-abortion activists who are politically active in the Republican Party, will they be okay with his explanation of why
he didn't appeal his decision? I mean, the people that are focused on that strategy, on the bigger picture, on ultimately determining that Roe v. Wade is unconstitutional, will understand this. You know, and they're sophisticated enough in understanding what is trying to be done here.
He's not giving up the fight. He's just focusing on his slightly.
Yeah, frankly, it's a distinction without a difference. He's still fighting for that law.
All right. Well, finally, the Young Democrats of America National Convention was in Indianapolis this week, as I mentioned, and one of the slogans in heavy use, particularly on social media, was Young Gets It Done. But we are in Indiana, so Mike O'Brien, did the Young Dems give Senator Todd Young his next campaign slogan?
I'd steal that all day long. You kidding me? But some of my best ideas haven't been mine.
Well, you got a free slogan from Nikki Kelly earlier in the show.
So,
I mean, I get Young Gets It Done, but... in a state where your senator is Todd Young.
You know, what the heck. It's a national convention. You know, most of the people aren't from Indiana. And
I think
to have that slogan work for him, he's going to have to show the same kind of backbone that Susan Brooks showed. And I don't see that as yet from Todd Young.
Democrats I talked to at the convention say they're happy if Todd Young wants to try to use it, because if you look at that hashtag on Twitter, it's a bunch of young progressives on there. So is it a, you know, does Todd Young still have to be careful about how much he appropriates that?
I think he can come up with another one.
And yet the Republican Party was, the Indiana Republican Party used it a lot on Twitter this week.
They probably could. But you think about it, which is an easier hashtag to not only remember, but type millennial? That's so multi.
You could do something young,
it's right there.
Yeah, that's true. And they are the young Democrats.
You could do teachers before swine or something like that could really make a distinction.
Maybe when pigs fly.
The last question we have fun with. We're not here to make policy. That's
Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world. Working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.